a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today we have a literary agent. Actually, we have two on both halves, Susan Shulman and Gary Height. First up is Susan Shulman. In 1980, she founded her boutique agency that represents fiction and nonfiction, playwrights and subsidiary film and translation rights for other agencies and publishers. And I'm going to cough. Oh, dear. Anyway, prior to establishing her own agency, she was an agent at ICM. Her agency focuses on commercial fiction and nonfiction, literary fiction, narrative and political nonfiction, and business, investing, finance nonfiction, health-related books, memoir, self-help, wisdom, and body-mind-spirit nonfiction books about the arts, in particular creativity and writing, and in particular fiction and nonfiction for, by, and about women and women's issues and interests. Let's bring her on. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Will you talk a little bit about how you found your way to agenting?
I think like every agent, we have our own path. There is no official training for an agent. I started out as an assistant professor of English, and thus that reflected my interest in the written word, and I specialized in history of the English language and in Renaissance drama. And in fact, my list very much continues to reflect those very basic interests, the early interests. And I specialized in linguistic and history of the English language and moved to New York to work at Columbia University. But as the fate took over and the job didn't pan out the way I hoped that it would, and for the summer, while I was waiting for another position at Columbia, I worked for a literary agent, and it was very clear after about the first or second week of the job that I had found my love. It combined reading with business, and so I was able to read material that came in fresh. We could have a fax coming over from Garrison Keillor submitting, you know, a story to the New Yorker. And at the same time, I knew that I could make a living from working, selling intellectual property rights. So it was actually a very natural path because of my interest. And I've been at it almost 30 years and enjoyed almost every minute of it. So it was a good choice.
Mm. And you're also, you're unusual in that you handle writers for the theater as well as film, TV, and that's seems to be unusual.
It is unusual, but I found after working at International Creative Management, that where in a large packaging agency, you're assigned to a department, and you're really not permitted, nor does it make sense in a business model for an agent in the film department to be selling stage rights.
Mm-hmm.
But I was able to work as a beginning agent. I was able to work in all the departments. And the goal, of course, in a large packaging agency generally is to find out, you know, what you're good at, what your interests are, what a good match might be if you were to be an agent in a company like William Morris or ICM. And I found actually that my interest was in the property and the writer as opposed to a certain kind of representation, a certain area of intellectual property rights. As you probably know and your listeners know, there is a body of rights that adheres to a copyright. There are about 400 rights, and they're always growing. I have sold, and most agents have sold many rights in their specialty, but you can sell everything from, you know, North American English language rights, which is the common book deal that's done in this country, down to clay animation rights, which is a kind of a small film right, and that's kind of like the Dancing Raisins.
Mm-hmm.
I sold those clay animation rights to God's Trombones, which actually got nominated for Academy Award.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
And so I found that I was interested in the property more than I was interested in being an agent for plays.
Mm-hmm.
And so that plays out in my list, for example, a book like Holes by Lewis Sacker, which won the National Book Award.
Mm-hmm.
Holes is published in North America. That was the original deal that was done by my co-agent, Ellen Levine, who is at Trident Media. And she assigned me the other, out of the 400, body of 400 rights, she assigned me about 200 of them, which is described as a catch-all phrase of motion picture television and allied rights and live stage rights. So we sold motion picture rights to Walden Media, who had the film distributed by Disney. It was distributed around the world. I think there were 27 different territories sold for the film. But at the same time, Lewis Sacker adapted the novel for live stage, and it was produced at Seattle Children's Theater. So at that moment in time, all of these rights were being exploited simultaneously, and I feel that that actually helps business for everybody. So it was being read in several languages around the world. The film was distributed with Disney, and simultaneously it was being produced as a live stage production.
Interesting.
There's a lot of resistance in the film world to that kind of approach, but I found that it does nothing but feed business.
Mm-hmm.
And if the property is a good property, it follows that it's a good property. And so if somebody wants to see the film and then go see the play and buy the book, everybody benefits from it. And so my focus has always been on the property. I was laughing to myself when you described my interests, which were very long. It's very wide-ranging, so that I can sell a book called The Dog Intelligence Test, and I can also sell a book called Rise of the Creative Class or The Speculation Economy or a book on corporate governance. I'm kind of interested in everything,
mm-hmm.
and that's a good thing and a bad thing.
Mm. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Susan Shulman, a literary agent in New York City. As you were talking about rights, I was thinking that the fact that there are a million agents and that you don't need certification to be an agent, that anyone can hang up a sign that says they're an agent, and yet there's so much you need to know. How should writers parse, you know, who they go with, who they choose? Would you first advise someone to go to AAR and look up the agent, or what would you advise?
I'm always puzzled by that question. I don't have a straight forward answer. I do know that the end result is that you should be comfortable with the relationship, and that communication is key to everything. It's key in, you know, in all relationships. That's what keeps them balanced, and each party functioning is good communication. And when it breaks down, if there's no effort to repair it, I think that's the signal. How one finds the right agent, I think I feel actually frustrated for writers who may be excellent writers but are attempting to sort that out. The AR is a trustworthy source. That's the Association of Authors Representatives. As a member, we must sign the guides, the ethical canon to the AAR, which offers some protection. What is of great concern these days is research on the web. Anybody can say anything, and it's permanent. In fact, I represent a book which is, I think, doing very well on privacy on the web and the laws of privacy by Dan Solove, published by Yale University Press, which addresses exactly this, which is reputation and privacy as it pertains to the individual in the Internet community, and, you know, which is analogous to the Wild West. There are no laws. And Dan's book, as a lawyer at George Washington University, his book is about how the laws of privacy in the United States will evolve and pertain to the Internet, but it's not there yet. So the danger with the Internet is anybody can say anything about anyone. I myself have, you know, Googled myself to see what has been said. In general, it gives me faith that, you know, that it is basically, from that person's point of view, the truth of their experience. I feel, you know, confident that the community will continue to conduct itself in that way. Agents, I find, don't talk about their clients. We have a fiduciary obligation not to talk about financial, certainly, and all client business is private, so that the most I would find an agent, my colleague, or myself doing is posting a deal on Publisher's Marketplace, but even then only with the client's written approval of the language of that deal. So it doesn't work in the reverse. Agents can't get out there and shouldn't, I think, blog about their business. It's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that answers, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the Internet, you're right. There's so much info, but it does seem that using that, but really going to sources like AAR that are more reliable.
I've made very good connections with writers who attend writing conferences. For example, I attended a conference in June, the International Women's Guild, I believe it's called, run by Hannah Lore, and it's held at Skidmore annually.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened, this was a group of women. And it could be that because I have interests in books for, by, and about women and women's issues and interests, it was a good match. Maybe that's why they invited me.
Mm-hmm.
But out of that conference, I took on two people who were a very, very good match, and I became very friendly with the community of writers. And I was able to speak with them personally about who of my colleagues might be right for them. And it was just again, very good communication.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that conferences where you can connect personally with someone are very helpful. And, of course, other writers, writing groups, those are the ways to do it. But we also read our query letters and respond to them. And I certainly have found good clients from people who have submitted query letters cold.
Now, if somebody is querying you regarding fiction, the query letter is a business letter, so you're not necessarily going to write it in the same voice or tone as the novel that you're writing. So how does a query letter for fiction, say, translate in terms of, do you hear voice coming through, or are you strictly... looking to what the story's about and seeing if that engages you or the writer's background, or how does that work?
It's both. It certainly is the voice. A good letter is a good letter, and it reflects a control of the language. a mastery of the form. You know, writing a good letter is really difficult. And I think I look at all of that, but I'm also looking at the subject. For example, I don't handle, my list is humanistically based, which means that my driving philosophy is that what I'm going to represent, it adds to kind of the human experience as opposed to detracting from it, so that I'm not going to handle exploitive material. And in particular, I don't have a real sympathy, say, for a serial killer novel. And so I can tell if the plot is a serial killer mystery and it's outlined and it's, you know, it's got a lot of violence in it, it probably isn't for my sensibilities. And that's not to say it won't be a bestseller. It's just, do I want to spend a year or two working on it? And I'm not comfortable taking that assault every day when I have to pitch it. So I can tell from the writing in the letter, as well as the content of what their novel is about, if it's right for me. But of course, there's always the exception, and I'm thinking in particular of a cold query letter that I got from a very, very young writer who had not yet entered college. And, you know, it was written from the point of view of a 17-year-old writer who had three complete novels. And really, I just felt that anyone who was 17 and had already written three complete novels deserved to be read. Mm-hmm. And I asked for the one that was written most recently because I felt just maturation would, the novel would benefit from it. And it was, you know, a YA, and it was a wonderful experience. And the novel, in fact, was sold to the publisher of Random House Children's Books. I guess it's intuition. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, as agents are human beings, it could be how you're feeling that day, how busy you are, whether or not you've personally taken a blow in your own life. All kinds of things influence. All I can say is, in terms of advice to writers, is keep writing, keep at it, keep writing that, and keep at that, and keep going, because persistence pays off.
Mm. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI, broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm with Susan Shulman, founder of the Susan Shulman Literary Agency in New York. In terms of fiction, fiction writers hear such dismal predictions about the novel and what's to happen, and that the memoir is taking over the novel as a form, and that, you know, just dire stuff. Can you enlighten us a bit? Is it extremely difficult to sell fiction, or as hard as it's always been, or does it depend on the fiction?
I think anybody who spends 30 years of their life kind of day-to-day being an agent, working in this business, has to be an optimist. So if my comments are colored by the fact that my personality is I'm basically an optimist, and I have a true love for literary fiction. My colleagues of kind of my generation, we grew up in just the bliss of wonderful writing and of a healthy publishing industry with lots of publishers to choose from, where the voice stood out, and the voice convinced an editor, and an editor took on a writer and a project with a personal conviction. We all know that the world has changed. Agents know it. Writers know it. I want to stay in an optimistic position because I do believe that good writing begets readers who then write. On the other hand, I'm also a realist, and I do think that there's so much competing for the consumer's attention that fiction suffers. And we are going through a phase of realism with reality-based television shows, reality-based memoir. even if colored with, you know, elements of fiction, or fiction written as pseudo-memoir. And I think that that will pass, and we may return to strong literary fiction. I don't know. I'm much more interested in preserving the readership and any way that we can do that. So I myself have a Sony ebook reader. I have 150 manuscripts on it, training myself to read fiction on a screen. And because the person who was born after 1985 does that automatically. I don't do that automatically. So I think that it's going electronic. After all, books are made from resources like trees and oil. The trucks are driven with oil. The print is oil. And the consuming of those natural resources, we have a new attitude toward it in our country, and economically we have to. So it doesn't, you know, electronic bites are free.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if we're going to have a lively fiction market, it needs to be, we need to anticipate it that it's going to become electronic, and I'm trying to move in that direction myself and encourage. My office is, as of January 1st, is we're attempting to be a green office. About the market, I don't know. I wish I did. But is it harder to sell a novel? Yes.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
I know. But people are still writing and still reading, but they're reading online.
Yeah.
And so I have to, the only little bit I know about it is that it's going electronic. And how that pans out, how the deals pan out, is my concern as an agent is to, in this interim transitional time, is to guard the intellectual property rights for electronic rights, for e-books, for print on demand, and watch that very carefully and protect it for the client so that when it becomes clear as to which way it's going to go, we'll know. After all, you know, a year ago, who would have thought of selling stories, short stories, that would be distributed on your telephone, on your, you know, your...
Oh, the iPhone or the cell phone?
Yeah, iPhone.
Sure.
And now, in Japan, it happened 3 years ago, and now Barry Yorgrau's nasty stories are going to be distributed on your cell.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know... that's fiction. People are reading it.
Right.
They're reading it in shorter bites.
Mm.
So I have to be optimistic about that and look to new markets, protect the rights so that for my clients, those rights are available and held by them so that whatever that market is, we're ready.
Mm-hmm. We have another 2 minutes left. In terms of fiction, you had mentioned your 17-year-old YA author. Is young adult still a thriving market? And do you see it continuing to be?
I'm sorry, which market?
Young adult fiction.
Young adult. I think young adult is oversold in many areas. And in particular, those stories featuring young adults who have suffered bulimia, anorexia, dysfunctional family, adoption, abuse. There is such, and I'm glad for this and sold some of those books. I'm glad that there is a body of young adult literature on which readers can draw to learn about life and how to relive their life better. But I do think that that area of young adult is oversold. Now, it's the only area of young adult that I know, and so I can't speak to, say, fantasy or science fiction in that area. I don't know that area.
Mm. Susan, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
You've been so informative, and I love just the depth you've gone into regarding rights and everything else. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Barbara.
You're quite welcome.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
That was Susan Shulman talking to us from New York. Her agency is the Susan Shulman Literary Agency. You can find her in the various books and online and through AAR, the Association of Author Representatives. Do stay tuned. We will be back shortly with another literary agent, Gary Height. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. You can also find us through iTunes. Go to public radio, scan down for KUCI, and do a double click, and you'll be on listening to us. We podcast these days, too. There's 200-plus shows up. This one should go up in a couple of weeks at most. If you go to my website, which is penonfire.com, click on the radio tower on the left side of the screen, and there you will see the radio page with the schedule and whatever else is there, past shows and other info. Also, also directions to get to the podcast page. And it's free of charge, of course. You can listen to all the shows, any show. They're all there for you. We are back with another literary agent, Gary Height. He's an agent with Fine Print Literary Management in New York. Clients include Charles Yu, who recently won the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Award, selected by Richard Powers. Jim Gerard, author of Who Moved My Secret and Beam Me Up, Jesus, humor books from Nation Books. Platinum Studios Comics, The Church of the Subgenius, and David Carson, author of Medicine Cards. Let's bring him on. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Barbara. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Great. Great to have you. Talk a little bit about how you found your way to agenting. I see from your background that you have quite a varied background, interesting background. Talk about that.
Well, I come to it actually from the writing side. College, I wrote a lot of novels, and I had two different agents at different times. Neither of them got any of my work published, and then over the years have done columns and had my poetry published, and several plays that I've written have been produced. And around 2001, I decided to pull one of my old novels out, polish it up, and get an agent. And I did actually end up having a meeting with an agent who was a friend of a friend. And after I met her, I decided this looks like a fun job. I love to read, and now I have a sort of incessant flow of reading material for the rest of my life. And I've really been enjoying it, and I think my background as a writer has really helped me to sympathize with my clients and try to guide them sympathetically.
Mm. Now, are you an agent that relies on referrals, or do you love sort of manuscripts that come in or query letters that come in over the transom, and just, you know, you just discover somebody? How do you find most of your clients?
Well, a lot of them have come to me through queries, and I would say probably 90% of them started off by sending me a letter or an email, and I just find somebody whose voice I find irresistible and get really passionate about the book. Now, of course, I think Susan was telling you just recently that, you know, literary fiction, and probably your listeners all know this, is very difficult, and I'm really into literary fiction. So that's been very challenging, but extremely rewarding when it happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love that you like or love fiction, because as I was, you know, talking to Susan about that, it seems that more and more agents are not selling fiction, or not selling fiction as much as they used to, or just really turning to nonfiction and disregarding fiction entirely.
Well, it's funny. For some years before I started this business, I'd say maybe in the decade prior, there may have been 5 or 6 years in there in which I read barely any fiction. All I was reading was history or things about science and various kinds of things. And I think that there's a big percentage of the audience, especially male audience, that has sort of drifted away from fiction, and literary fiction especially. A lot of times when I see people reading fiction on the train or literary fiction, they're sticking with the classics. They're guaranteed to get something good if they pick up a Joseph Conrad book or Henry James or something like that. So that just rather than spend the very high prices of new books today, I mean, hardbacks are mid-20s, up over 30 sometimes, and trade paperbacks up almost $20 these days. And they want something that's, you know, guaranteed to be good, which is really tough. And one thing that I tell writers everywhere that I go, when I go to writers' conferences, especially writers who are distressed by how difficult it is for them to get their work published, is that if everybody in the country who writes literary fiction would buy 12 new literary novels a year,
mm-hmm.
It would be a tremendous boon to the business, because their chances of getting published would go up. Secondly, I guarantee you they'll find some great writers, because there are a lot of great writers out there. And to find somebody who meets your taste can be a little bit like finding a needle in the haystack, but a lot of literary writers that I talk to feel almost a sense of being in competition with other contemporary writers.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're almost reluctant to like what's out there. And sometimes they'll even, go out of their way to avoid something that they've heard about. And granted, I do have read a lot of literary fiction in the last few years that I was very lukewarm about, and especially sometimes the ones that get the most recognition and get all the good reviews. I'll read them and I'll be really unenthused. But then, if you dig a little deeper, some of the stuff that's maybe not so well known, there are a lot of really great authors out there today doing great stuff.
Yeah.
And they're having a hard time selling these books. A new literary novel that comes out today is really lucky to sell 3,000 copies.
Hmm. Now, does it make more sense? You mentioned the cost of trade paperbacks and hardbacks, and even though the cost of trade paperbacks is going up, it's still less than a hardback. Does it? And a lot of authors want their first novel or second or third to be published as a hardback, but to me, it makes a lot of sense to be willing and even welcoming that, you know, to go into trade paperback. What are your thoughts on that? Does it make more sense to just do that so that more people will buy your book?
I think a first-time author coming out with a trade paperback can be a really good strategy. Now, if the house is really going to get behind you and pull out all the stops and promote you in hardback, that's great too. You'll get marginally more reviews with a hardback than you do with a paperback. And of course, the royalties are much better on hardback. But at the same time, you know, in terms of people maybe not knowing who you are and taking a chance on your book, I think they're more likely to take that chance on a trade paperback.
And is that something an author can encourage a publisher to do, or are they already set? They've gone through marketing. It's, you know, marketing has decided what they're going to do. If an author comes and says, you know, I really don't want a hardback, I want a trade paperback, is that something that's done?
Well, I would, you know, there are limits to how much control an author has over these things. Like, they, you know, authors are not given the ability to design their own cover, things like that. And, you know, there are many different ways that a relationship with a publisher can progress. And, you know, if you're lucky, the editor who acquired you will still be at the house when the book comes out and will be able to stand behind it and push for you internally within the company and get the salespeople to really push it to the big chains and so forth. In terms of if an author should try to change the plans for their book that the publishing house comes up with, in terms of a first novelist who doesn't have much clout, I would say save your energy for other battles.
Mm-hmm.
Put all of your energy into getting the word out about your book and promoting your book, whether they put it out in hardback or trade paperback, rather than trying to, tilt at windmills and try to get more control over the way that your book is packaged, which you're, you know, basically going to be banging your head against a brick wall in most cases.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Gary Hyde. He's an agent with Fine Print Literary Management in New York. In terms of promotion and all that, do you look at, first of all, do you look at an author's platform or presence in the world, in the country, in their region, and does that influence whether you take them on or not, or does it depend on whether they're sending you nonfiction or fiction?
Well, it's, you know, as I'm sure you've heard many times, it's extremely important, and you know, basically the reason for that is that, well, there are a lot of reasons, and first and foremost, what they mean by platform is, can you sell the book yourself, basically?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, from a business standpoint, if a publisher is going to buy a book to publish, they're definitely more likely to buy it from someone who's going to be able to guarantee them, you know, 5,000, 10,000 sales. Now, that used to be, it really is still more true of nonfiction than fiction. But these days, every couple months you hear about another major newspaper that has dropped its reviews section.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to Jack Shoemaker, who's currently running or senior editing at Counterpoint Books. And I believe he was the founder of Counterpoint. He was saying, that actually, in terms of the submissions that he gets there, he feels like what he's getting is of higher quality than it's ever been, the submissions that he's getting in.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he can publish fewer than he has been able to in the past. And one reason is, he told me that 15 years ago, any novel they published would be more or less guaranteed a dozen reviews. And he says today, a novel that they put out is lucky to get one review.
Mm-hmm. Well, then what about other media streams? What about radio? What about blogs? What about online magazines? What about all that sort of things that have started to happen to promote? Do they, I'm assuming then in terms of what he might say, is that they don't mean as much as a great review in the New York Times?
Well, at this point, for example, you know, if you have a review from a major daily newspaper, people are very comfortable putting that blurb on the book cover of a later edition.
Mm-hmm.
They're still not that comfortable with putting on, you know, joesmith.blogspot.com.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't have the weight still. But I think that's the way that things are going to head. And I would really encourage literary writers out there to become very, you know, I'm sure many of them are already, but to do more so, being engaged in a literary culture. And, you know, wherever you are, you can sort of nurture a literary culture where people are writing book reviews, reading each other's work. You know, you can, anybody nowadays can start up a blog and start reviewing books.
Mm-hmm.
If you're really ambitious, I bet you, you know, could do that for a while and then start sending off for review copies and getting yourself some free merchandise.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, what about Amazon reviews? It seems that a lot of people seem to pay attention to, especially, you know, solid Amazon reviewers and what they're saying about books.
Mm-hmm. I'm not terribly impressed by the general level of reviewing that's going on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
But there are quite a few other online sources of reviews that I think are really good. There's one I just came across. It's at newpages.com/magazine/litmags. And this is actually reviews of literary magazines, which I also encourage writers to read as many of those as possible. There's a new one coming out of some sort of beatnik collective here in New York called smokesignalsmag.com that has a reviews section. And I'm sure you've seen tons of other ones. But I think it behooves any writer, especially somebody who's picking up as difficult a row to hoe as literary fiction, to know and to find out as much as they can about today's literary culture,
mm-hmm.
and to engage in it.
Yes,
in any way that they can.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. We have a little bit of time left with Gary Hyde, a literary agent with Fine Print Literary Management in New York. Wanted to ask you a bit about comics and graphic novels, because it seems that you do handle comics, and wonder what, you know, where all of that is at. I notice now bookshelves, and have for some time, in some of the major bookstores with anime and other graphic novels. And is that expanding? Has it been saturated? What do you think?
The graphic novel shelf is the fastest growing shelf in the major chains. And I don't remember the exact statistic, but it's been ballooning far more than any other section. I think that there are two very different sorts of things that are both called graphic novels. And One is the sort of thing, American Splendor, Persepolis, Mouse, Art Spiegelman, that's very high art and very literary, and I think it stands up with any literature. And then there's another kind of graphic novel, which is more of a continuation of the comics tradition, which are, you know, fun, vibrant action stories that, you know, whether they're in the superhero genre or they're in some other sort of action adventure genre, generally tend to have a very fast-moving plot, sometimes, you know, costumed villains and whatnot. And then there are some books like Alan Moore's Watchmen that, sort of stand in both camps. And what I see with publishers and with the bookstores is the sales of the more literary graphic novels, as you might suspect, you know, with the exception of certain blockbusters, have been less than the publishers have expected. And yet, the sales of these, the more traditional comics-based graphic novels, have been very robust. And I don't think that that's surprising. I think that it's important for, you know, publishers have been sort of gradually getting into graphic novels tentatively to a large extent. I mean, they've built up big manga divisions, but they're, you know, it's a different paradigm. It's, they're much more expensive to print than traditional books, so the profit margins are a little bit lower. And they're just learning, the publishing houses are just learning this market still. And so some of the biggest players are, you know, traditional comic companies like DC's Vertigo line, mm-hmm. Or Marvel does a lot of graphic novels, Dark Horse, EC. And what I've been working on primarily has been I've worked with Arcana Comics and with Platinum Studios Comics, which are very sort of action-driven, very adventure-oriented, not so much costume superhero lines of comics. But both of these companies are really involved in selling the movie rights to these books. And so then there's been consequently a great deal of interest on the part of the publishing companies in publishing these books that already have upcoming tentpole movie attached to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, this has been great for me. And at the same time, I am keeping my eye out as well for some, you know, literary graphic novels as well. In which there have been some great ones published. There's a one that just came out, St. Martin's did, with Nick Bertozzi, who's an award-winning artist and writer, called The Salon, which is about, it's sort of a murder mystery involving Picasso and Gertrude Stein. And it's really quite funny. Bertozzi actually used to do a comic called The Incredible Drinking Buddies,
mm-hmm.
Many years ago, and I was really pleased to see this. But I mean, there's all kinds of great stuff being published, and how do people find it? You know, this is something that I think writers need to work a lot harder on, seeking out, you know, the best stuff that's out there, being influenced by it, interacting with it.
Hmm. What about, you know, the whole idea that, books are going electronic? First, you know, what do you think about that? And then secondly, are books also going shorter? And would that be a benefit if books are going electronic to have shorter books so that they're just...
Yeah, that, you know, paper's been getting more expensive, and they have been, I think a lot of the new novels coming out these days tend to be around 70,000 words,
mm-hmm.
whereas it might have, a few years back, been more normal to see 90,000 or 100,000 words. And in terms of electronic, I think it's, you know, it is coming, but they have been saying it is coming, you know, for 10 years now at least. And it's, first of all, I think it depends on when a cheaper reader comes out. You know, the Kindle is something like $400.
Yeah.
The Sony reader is a couple hundred dollars. I don't think it's really going to take off until they sell enough of these readers that they're in the $50 range.
Sure.
And then I think it could be great because with lower production costs, hypothetically, hopefully, we can negotiate for much higher royalties for our authors.
Mm-hmm.
A larger percentage of what you pay for the book will go to the author.
Right, instead of production.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully also, I'm hoping that the ebook will, in a way, bring back the mass market paperback, in a sense that you can buy a cheap book,
mm-hmm.
Which a lot of people don't realize. You know, this is one of the reasons why we had so much great literature in the 50s and 60s. I mean, Grove Press could do really cheap books. They could publish William S. Burroughs in these little pulpy paperbacks and make some money on it.
And wouldn't they sell them for something like 85 cents or 95 cents? I mean, some ridiculous amount of money.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It was just, you know, almost as cheap as getting a newspaper or
mm-hmm.
something like that. And I even remember in my own childhood being able to pick up a paperback for $2-3.
Right.
And that makes it so much easier to experiment and to try some writer you've never heard of. And that's my dearest hope, is that if and when the ebook comes, that it's going to allow people to try, you know, different things cheaply.
Mm-hmm. Probably one of the difficulties is one that I have, which is I love books. I love to have them in the house. I love to have them in every room, you know, even
mm-hmm.
the bathroom. And it just wouldn't be the same to have, say, an ebook in every room, you know, loaded with books. You know, you still want the physical copies. But again.
And, yeah, I wonder how that's going to play out, because if the ebook does become dominant, what is that transition period going to be like? Is it going to be like the transition period between VHS and DVD,
mm-hmm.
Which was rather sudden, I think, or is it going to be a really long, slow process? And what will happen to the bookstore?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what will happen to? I'm sure used bookstores are still going to be with us for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, gradually morphing into antique stores, as it were.
Oh, dear, that's depressing.
And
anyway.
Are they still going to be, for, you know, years and years, will they still be printing large print books for us old fogies who still love the feel of paper?
Oh, dear. Well, you have been a delight. I wonder if you have any sort of last words for the writers listening.
Yes, everybody should read Charles Yu's Third Class Superhero, Tito Perdue's Lee, and Fields of Asphodel. And then some that I don't represent, I really enjoyed Carol M. Schwiller's The Mount recently from Small Beer Press. And Lionel Garcia, Church of the Subgenius. There's just tons of great writers out there, so get out there and buy some new books.
That's right. That, you know, that's so much a part of it. Instead, I mean, I use the library all the time, but I also invest in books. And aside from the books that come here for the show that are thrown at my door by UPS, and
mm-hmm.
you know, we have to keep buying books to keep it going.
Well, libraries are great too, because you can try out an author there, and then you'll probably buy their next book that comes out.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Hey, nice talking to you, Barbara.
That was Gary Hite talking to us from New York. He's with Fine Print Literary Management, and you can find him at online, in books, here and there. And anyway, it's great. Both of my agents today, both of the guests were wonderful, and some days I love being here. I love being here all the time, but some shows are just quick shows, you know? Love what people are saying. Anyway, if you want to know more about Writers on Writing, go to my website at penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you want to be on my weekly email list. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Confucius, who said, "It does not matter how slowly you go along, so long as you do not stop." That very much relates to writing, doesn't it? You know, just keep moving on your work. Paragraph a day, a page a day, a line a day. Just keep going. Don't stop. Thanks so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire. I'll see you next time.